It's been an interesting day, listening to what I've heard so far and seeing some of the parallels and links between what we are experiencing in the north of Ireland as well. So what I'll do today is, I want to touch quite a bit on some of the positives, because there are some terrific positives about the way people have faith, have responded to a conflict that in itself was deeply entrenched in faith traditions, so let's put it that way. So there's a lot that's positive to say, but I also feel that I really need to go back over some of history. I know that if you're of a certain age and watched a lot of news bulletins, you feel you probably know more than most about the Northern Ireland conflict and why on earth in the northeast of Ireland there should have been a conflict at all. But I do want to rehearse that again, because I think if I start talking about some of the initiatives that have happened in recent years that have been by people of faith, unless we get a clear idea in our mind of what preceded and still is there, bubbling under, as was phrased in the talk before last, then we won't get a clear enough picture. So I suppose one place I want to start is by saying, you know, when we look at that Islamic world, sort of with a cockpit in the Middle East and spreading around there, and see the huge cultural and religious and political conflicts that are so threatening and so grim in so many ways, it's important to remember that Europe had those. That Europe in the 17th century was immersed, Christendom was immersed in a conflict that involved millions of people being slaughtered. And that very often it was about Protestant on Protestant, Catholic on Protestant. It was, and it is still called by the historians, the religious wars. And what is even more disarming, I think, perhaps, and seemed disarming, I think, to a secularizing Britain in the 1960s, 69, when our troubles started, it was disarming to think that in Britain and in the UK, that a manifestation of that 17th century religious war was still mapped onto political conflict inside the doors and behind the boundaries of the United Kingdom. So I just want to talk a little bit, therefore, as I say, about the conflict, how it came to be, in my opinion, how it went on, and then how we got out of it to a large degree. And the role, perhaps, that churches and Christians played and still play in trying to address the issues. Northern Ireland's about 1.8 million people at the moment. It has risen in population, but 1.6 million through most of the conflict. And the number of deaths at first seems small compared with the horrors of what's going on in Syria. Over 3,500 deaths is a small sum, even though we know each death matters to those who were bereaved by it. But if you think that it is a small place, Northern Ireland, the equivalent probably would be, if it had happened in England and Scotland, Britain would be 100,000 deaths and maybe 500,000 people physically injured. So you'll understand that also is accompanied by those who are psychologically impacted, those who intergenerationally are affected by all of that. The loss of a family member is never forgotten. And especially in divided societies, that is so. Things from the past retain their power. And I just think of that, my own family, my own grandfather, 1921, during an earlier episode of The Troubles, had his grocery van stolen by the Irish Republican Army and taken away. And that story was told in my family when I was a kid. Why do things, I suppose, in a divided society like ours, keep on mattering in ways that it's hard to get stopped? And part of the reason, I think, is because things remain volatile. Now, what I mean by that is demographically. All right, here's the example I would give you. When Northern Ireland was set up, and it was deliberately created to create a majority who were, and the religious word is Protestant, but the ethnic word is feeling themselves to be Scots and British rather than Irish. It was deliberately set up with a two-thirds majority, and that majority is about to disappear. Mm. It's about to go. And the number of children of what we call primary school age is now greater amongst the Catholic nationalist population than the unionists. Now, that doesn't mean to say we're going to vote it into the traditional United Ireland, because political affiliation doesn't necessarily equate to your kind of religious background. But nonetheless, you see the point there, that that creates instabilities of all kinds in terms of allegiance and affiliation and constitutional future. So that's an important thing to think about. Just to bandy four words that you're probably semi-familiar with about as we enter this conversation today. On the one hand, you have the nationalist population, who, as I say, are growing, who would, at their more militant end, be labelled as Republicans. And amongst those more militant ones who seek an Irish Republic that is from Donegal in the north to Cork in the south and completely free from Britain, there have been Irish Republican Army and similar groups who have engaged in a violent campaign. On the other side, you have unionists, speaks for itself, doesn't it? Want united permanently and as deeply as possible with Britain. And at the more extreme edge of it, what you have what's called loyalism, which very often manifests itself in the belief that the security forces simply weren't doing enough to tackle the IRA and that they would take the affair into their own hands. How does it all map onto religion? I think this is an important thing. So we're talking about, and I echo previous speakers, the value and the importance, perhaps even the uniqueness of what Christianity, our faith, can do to address the conflicts in the world. How on earth does it map onto religion, this ethnic conflict? Well, when I look at my own name, my surname, Orr, it's a Scots name. And I can go back in my ancestry to the early 17th century and see the arrival of my family precedent on my male masculine side over to Ireland, and the beginning in the early 17th century of the what we call the plantation of Ulster. And this is a period when the migration from Europe is happening all over the world, often with not terribly happy consequences. On the one hand, you have 1620, the Pilgrim Fathers arriving into America. But the whole process of Europe's expansion around the world, many look on the plantation of Ulster in the early 17th century as being a laboratory for empire. It was trying out the sending over of willing people who would go across to the north of Ireland and make it a little more peaceful and a little more civilised. Because Ireland, of course, in the late 16th century, had been the scene of a very intensive war waged by Elizabeth I. And that war was against the Gaelic order in Ireland, the Gaelic chieftains, the Gaelic culture, which was, of course, deeply Catholic still, whereas England had embraced the Reformation, as had Scotland. And Ireland, in its previous state, was a backdoor through which could come the Spanish, and they did, Spanish Armada and so on. And in the 18th century, of course, later, France. In 1798, the French landed as part of a revolution. Always Ireland, a backdoor that Britain wanted to protect itself and keep tightly bolted shut. And I suppose you could say that the plantation of Ulster involving eventually the arrival of hundreds of thousands of people from my background, probably Scots Presbyterian by background, most of them, though not entirely, but certainly Protestant, and liable to be loyal to the crown, leads to a situation where you have tectonic plates, to use a word from earlier today, tectonic plates shifting in that little part of Ireland, the northeast in particular. And so, I mean, I think that's how it gets mapped onto religion, and religion gets mapped onto it. But to point out the way to you that in a divided society, everything matters, right down to the paving stones and the way they're painted in an inner city estate. For example, if I tell you that I'm here from Northern Ireland, many of my Catholic nationalist friends will say, no, it's not Northern Ireland. You can't call it that. That's to give a kind of authenticity, false authenticity, to the British ownership of our part of Ireland. It's the six counties, right? We have a joke about that. You know, there's a thing called the Ulster Fry. It's a heart attack on a plate. Yes. But the Ulster Fry, a kind of breakfast. And, of course, in nationalist areas, we wonder whether it's called the Six Counties Fry, you know, after the six counties. You're not allowed to call it Ulster. I mean, that matters at so many levels. Sporting differences. For example, we had Northern Ireland through to the next stage of the European Championships. But I can guarantee that the Northern Ireland team is 99% or 98% supported by people from Protestant backgrounds. Not entirely. That's changing a bit. Whereas in the Irish News, the newspaper taken by my, well, I take it, but taken dominantly very often by Catholics and nationalists, the team to support is the Irish Republic. So right down to other issues, of course, and this again is where religion maps onto it. For a long period of time, in the event of British ownership of Ireland, British colonial ownership of Ireland, the Catholic Church was a refuge for what you felt as an Irish Gaelic person were your culture and your values. This was exaggerated even more in Northern Ireland after partition of Ireland, because, as you may know, Northern Ireland was not exactly ruled with a fair hand for a long period of time. It was seen, in the words of the Prime Minister, James Craig, and other premiers, as a Protestant province for Protestant people, mirrored, of course, by a Catholic country for a Catholic people in many ways in the south. But in that context, school and belonging to a Catholic school mattered a great deal, because that is where, in a way, your ancient culture, your ancient Irish language that was 1,000 years old when English was created, that was a repository of the Breton laws that were destroyed by the arrival of a new legal system in the 16th and 17th century. This was the repository of your ancient faith and the culture and values as well. So it's understandable that within Northern Ireland, the Catholic Church system retained, and was endorsed with the money to do so, it retained its power. And the state system inevitably tended to be where people from Protestant backgrounds were educated. And you can see, therefore, the situation we've been talking about, at one or two of us, about this. You have a situation where you could easily go to school until you're 18 and never ever meet anyone from an other than a Protestant, at least culturally Protestant, background. And that's how it is in many, many ways. I mean, I think also we can't ignore the toxic nature of history in all of this. And I've already touched on some of it, I think, with you in the few moments I've already spoken. And when we think back to the 19th century, for example, just to give you a few population statistics here, 1845, the population of Ireland is about 8 million, right? In 1900, it's down to 4.5 million. It's only recently that it's climbed up towards its original amount, i.e. it's about 7 million now, north and south. And that, of course, is due to 1 million deaths from famine and disease in the space of about a year and a half, and then a subsequent terminal decline in the population through emigration due to poverty, due to hopelessness, and becomes a demographic habit. If that was the equivalent nowadays, England's population, by the way, was about 16 million in 1845, as I understand it. The population of England would now only be 14 million. Rather than what it is now. I'm talking about England and Wales together, sorry. And what I understand it to be now is somewhere between 55 and 60 million. Could you imagine what England looked like now if it was only 14 million people? It just would be. And where all the others had gone abroad. And nobody can understand Ireland or its landscape or what's happened to it without understanding that fundamental, like, sense of wounding that history has delivered, a sense of wounding by that experience. Alongside that, of course, what happens in Ireland, paradoxically, is that in the northeast, where Protestant population dominated in the late 19th century, you had industrial revolution. Now, it was affected to some degree still by the famine. I could take you to famine graveyards where there are 3,000 or 4,000 people buried anonymously under a stone that says they all had names. But nonetheless, by the early 20th century, you have the biggest shipyards in the world launching the Titanic. You have linen, the queen of fabrics, made in Belfast. And so you have this radical contrast between how the Protestant population, especially those of a middle and upper class background, experience that period of history, and that devastating sense in the southwest of Ireland that empire had destroyed you culturally, religiously, and every other way. So it's in that context then, at the start of the 20th century, that you have the urge for self-government in Ireland. Initially, an urge to do that constitutionally. You have an Irish parliamentary party in London. There's a desire for home rule, but it is deeply opposed by people like my ancestors, unionists. And it's really a country on the verge of civil war in 1914. When the war breaks out in August 1914, Ireland is a tinderbox. The war postpones it, but doesn't postpone it. Because in the midst of it, in Easter 1916, you have a rising. Seeking German help the way previous generations had sought French help or Spanish help. And that rising is put down in a way that I think the British government has never quite learned about how to handle, i.e. very swiftly under court-martial rules, the leaders were shot. What I say is never learnt quite, because during the more recent troubles, when you had a penal regime introduced by Margaret Thatcher that took away political status from prisoners and introduced an H-block regime that meant that people were in solitary confinement as criminals, the response was a hunger strike in which a whole range of people, 10 or so, voluntarily lost their lives, took their own lives, hungered to death, if you like, which totally transformed the game for Republicans and Nationalists and brought in support never imagined beforehand. So I'm saying then is that by 1920-21, an Irish Republican army had been set up, fought the British Army and its coup participants, if you like, security forces. And by 1921, you had a truce between Britain and the Irish Republican Army and the formation of a border in Ireland. In the south, you have an Irish Free State, which works its way gradually towards total independence by the 1940s. And in Northern Ireland, you have a state, which is Northern Ireland. Now, where again does religion, where does faith map onto this religion? Well, to give you a little instance, when the Northern Ireland Parliament was created in 1921, before its new Parliament building was set up at Stormont, a rather grandiose building, which you could probably administer South Asia from, never mind six counties in Ireland. Before that was set up, the Presbyterian College, the Presbyterian Seminary, was the site of the Northern Ireland government. The Commons met in the library, and the Senate, or Lords, in this, the equivalent of the Lords, met in the chapel. Well, if that's not a statement about the coordination and link over between religion and politics, I don't know what is. But then, on the other hand, you know, there are aspects to, and I know no Baptist would agree with it, but you know, there are aspects to the connection between the Church of England and the state that are pretty substantial, are there not? You know, it's not uniquely a Northern Ireland thing. But I suppose what is to be said is that whole period from 1921 through to 1969, there was a sort of a quiescent, kind of quiet sort of covering over of so many wrongs and iniquities that needed addressed. For example, what we call gerrymandering, in which electoral boundaries were drawn so that you created artificial unionist majorities that weren't there at all. There were issues of employment, in which there was a clear bias towards Protestants in jobs, particularly the good jobs. And there was a policing regime that wasn't quite a police state in the Stalinist sense, but not far off it in one way. I think the statistics would be that there was one armed police man for every three or four Catholic families. And if that's not a regime that's designed to create hostility, I don't know what is. Having said that, it mirrors what happened in Europe, doesn't it? 1918-19, Treaty of Paris, Versailles, the idea of national sovereignty, the paradigm of self-determination, Woodrow Wilson and all of that, and you create countries all across post-empire Europe that have majorities and minorities, and of course the classic example would be the Sudeten Germans. You know, a pretext then for Hitler's move at the start of the Second World War. I mean, to be trapped in a country as Northern Catholics were, that they felt no ownership of, it's not a unique phenomenon. Well, by 1969, with the rise around the world of consciousness of civil rights issues, classically in America with Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, led to a hunger for civil rights issues in the northern part of Ireland. And it was met pretty severely with opposition from Protestants who felt that it was a thin end of a wedge. And riots broke out in places they'd broken out from time to time before over the previous century. The army came in. Relationship between the British army and the nationalist population in particular deteriorated very quickly indeed. And before long, you had the major players to the conflict, the Irish Republican Army and other Marxist fellow travellers. You had loyalist paramilitaries who were determined by all means to oppose that. And you had the security forces, the British government's security forces, also a player in the conflict in many, many ways. The period right up until the first ceasefire, which begins to terminate the Troubles in 1994, is characterised by massive imprisonment. We touched on that a little bit. Ghettoisation and, I suppose, a feeling very often of a compromised religious witness. And I suppose what I'm going to talk about is that during the rest of the talk, you know, in many, many ways. Now, by compromised, I mean, for example, coming from Protestant background myself, many people from Protestant backgrounds, sincere believing Christians who cherished the Bible and a sincere interpretation of it, and stood in a long Presbyterian tradition with a Calvinist roots in many ways, I would say, felt pretty strongly that unless that was maintained in Northern Ireland, unless that was maintained, unless the Protestant faith was cherished and maintained, something equivalent to the fears I've heard expressed earlier today about mosques and about an encroaching militant Islam, that something similar would happen with a Catholic church that had shown itself to be, especially in the south of Ireland, pretty well prone to dominating the everyday life of everyday people. So it's an understandable fear. On the other hand, inside the Catholic church, looking across, or from a Catholic nationalist in the north of Ireland, looking across and seeing people like the Reverend Paisley coming to power, who was militant in every way, unapologetically seeing himself as like a 17th century figure who was fighting the Reformation all over again at every minute, and had inhabited and imbibed a lot of the fundamentalism of the deep south of the USA, by the way, which had infiltrated the Presbyterian Calvinistic ethos through him. This became what I call a compromised scenario in so many ways. What I want to say is this, of course, before I just do that, 1994, you have the beginnings of the possibility of peace. 1998, we have a Good Friday Agreement, followed in 2006 by a second agreement called the St. Andrews Agreement, which endeavoured to clear up some of the stuff in the first one. What did it involve? It involved an amnesty for prisoners, political prisoners. How difficult is that? But how necessary? I don't think there's a peace agreement in the world that doesn't have that. But it creates problems. You have someone who has been in there for killing, someone who is in your family, and you see them walk the streets. I mean, this has been an issue I've faced in churches. I've gone into churches and done talks, you know, about the agreement and talked about amnesties, and somebody will stand up and saying, how can I welcome into my church in the pew here somebody who pulled the trigger and killed my brother? To which there is no easy or humble, there's no easy answer. But the answer might be, if perhaps in ideal terms, if there's one place that it ought to be able to happen, it ought to be the church. Because it's going to happen on the bus on the way into Belfast city centre. It's going to happen in the political plate. It's going to happen in the marketplace. It's going to happen in Tesco's when you're buying something. And if it can't happen in the church, then the church, while it's understandable that the person might not want it to happen, there's a case to be made of what we've been talking about today is true, that the possibility of that remarkable thing ought to be able to be in the church. Decommissioning of weapons, demilitarisation, not only of the Irish Republican Army, but also of the British Army presence as well. Police reform, and that has already happened. And then the bugbear, consociational government. In other words, a mandatory coalition between the two forces that were two of the politically opposed forces working together. That's been so difficult, because how do you agree on stuff? You know, if you had to have a mandatory coalition of Labour and Conservative on every issue, you might get stuck in your legislation here, or stucker than you are. And then, you know, closer bond between the South and the North, a remarkable level of cooperation going on at all levels between the Republic and Britain, closer East-West relations, and then the difficult stuff, which again relates to church stuff and Christian faith. How do you deal with the past? Now, at one level, there's a judicial issue. A historical inquiries team. Are there things that need investigated? Are there crimes that are still unsolved? Should you investigate them? Is it a paradox if you're doing that, whilst at the same time releasing people from jail and on amnesty? But then the reconciliation stuff. To what degree is reconciliation founded on meeting people who did stuff to you, or whose community hosted people who did stuff to you, and actually finding out the story, understanding the story, listening to the story? And I just recently, 2 weeks ago, did a thing for an interchurch group in Ballymena, north of Belfast, on this very topic. These interchurch groups, by the way, are very important. They're small, but they are people from different church backgrounds meeting together in order to talk a lot about these kind of issues. But the thing that people wanted to talk about was this issue of the past. Do you turn away from it? Do you simply say, we can't deal with all of that? It's too messy. It's too complicated. How far back do you go? I've already been talking about the 16th century. I'm not talking about that. Or do you just, where does the trouble start? 69. But Northern Ireland was a place lacking in justice from 21. Should it have been set up at all? Do you talk about those things? Or do you just talk about individual biographies? These are the issues that are faced. And we know that the story of Christian faith is a story about coming to terms with the past through grace. It's about changing one's attitude to one's own past. It's about the way salvation deals with both the individual and collective sins that we inherit. That's at a theological level, but what does it like at the individual level? That's the question. And for individual churches as well. Let me just mention a couple of things that need negotiated before I realise I've talked on about the first bit, not so much about the second, but just to give you a couple of examples of things needing negotiated, right? In the church in Lurgan, like so many Protestant churches, with sincere Christian believers in them, right? They flew the Union flag quite a lot. Now, do you start taking that flag down? Because for many people in Lurgan, they do not identify with that flag and see it as being a flag used to wave at them to make a point. So what does the church do? Well, I could talk for ages about that. There's a whole... Do you see the issue? Recently, I was involved in a... I write books about the First World War, and there was a service to remember the dead of Gallipoli in Lisburn Cathedral. We had invitations to members of Sinn Féin, IRA's political party. In order to have them there, it's important that they're there, because that feels like some kind of a, you know, a reconciliatory thing to have them there in a building where the British military are present. But if you have God Save the Queen, and they have to stand up, well, they won't stand up, you have a diplomatic incident, you have bad feeling. So how do you negotiate to not have the Queen being sung? And who's going to be hurt by not having the Queen being sung? Do you see how at every little level in stuff that involves church, that involves the secular world, there are so many things to be dealt with? Some of the really important groups then that have worked hard for the last few years. I can't go past Corrymeela, because Corrymeela is a remarkable place. Now, what is it? Some of you already know. It comes from the Irish word Carrig Mella, which means the sweet rock or the beautiful rock. It's on a rock or a cliff face with a beautiful view over this North Atlantic. The founder is a man called Ray Davey, who had been a prisoner of war in the Second World War as a padre in the British Army. And he'd ended up at Dresden. And in 1945, he witnessed close at hand and was almost killed by the bombing of Dresden, in which thousands of civilians were killed, like tens of thousands who were also killed during the Allied bombardment of both Japan and Germany. He also got to know Lutheran Christians very well. He had freedom as a padre to move around the village of Hohenstein. When the war came to an end, the partisans saw him to freedom. But he tried his best to connect with Dresden, with the lady he'd got to know in Hohenstein, and couldn't do it. The Iron Curtain had come down, which grieved them. But in 1965, 3 or 4 years before the Troubles began, he founded this community with some of his students from Catholic and Protestant backgrounds at Queen's University up at Carrigmeela. It was connected initially to a more European-wide scenario, very influenced by a man called Padre Julio, whose agape community in northern Italy had a big influence on him. But it was a response to the European catastrophe. You could call it the catastrophe of Christendom. The catastrophe of Christendom. The place of Martin Luther, Germany, with barbarism beyond belief. So that's what is at the heart of it. But it's perfectly placed in 1969 to exercise a role in the Troubles. And it does and did so. What went on there, well, those of you who have been there will know some of the stories, but first of all, a refuge for people from Belfast and other places during the conflict, where they could feel some healing. It was a place when I was a teacher where we went up with schools, different schools, school groups, and talked and did classes and courses, thinking together about how we would deal with the future. And it has been a place where paramilitaries who would normally have been killing one another met in order to talk, way before the conflict even. The chapel is called the Cree in Irish, which could be interpreted as the tree. And what they're referring to is the tree of life. You know the tree in Revelations, whose leaves are for the healing of the nations. Beautiful image, yeah? And that's what we've been thinking about today, you know, in so many ways, haven't we? Both the nations and the world at large, and how that has all impacted, in particular, I think, in our states as well, you know, in inner city, in the inner city world. And by the way, Belfast has its own estates, and Newton Abbey and all around there. We've got those estates with comparable issues, gang warfare going on. But what else, then, is worth mentioning? The church I go to, Fitzroy Presbyterian Church, created a connection way back in the 70s with Clonard, which was a Catholic monastery and a parish of a kind on the Falls Road. In the early days when nobody was talking to the IRA, because they weren't even allowed to speak on the BBC, and again, I can understand why when you think of the bombing campaign, which was often brutal, but Fitzroy organised, in the local chaplaincy in particular, some of the first contacts that were made, some of the first whispers, the first conversations, when people could discover what you inevitably discover when you start to meet people who were once intent, in my case, because at one stage I worked for the British Army, intent on killing you. That they're actually very often remarkably similar people to you, except you weren't in their shoes and didn't experience the pressures on you to do what they did. Those meetings fascinated. And I remember one old fella in our church in Fitzroy saying that the first moment when he knew things were beginning to move along was when he got a card from Gerry Adams, head of Sinn Féin, on the death of his own mother, expressing sympathy. You know? And those little moments, and setting up those little moments, people of faith were deeply involved in. I think of another example here of the Four Corners Festival, which happens in Belfast now every year. Four Corners, maybe get a picture. But two friends of mine, my own clergyman, the Reverend Steve Stockman, and a Catholic priest, Father Martin McGill, heavily involved in endeavouring to get people, in church contexts in particular, to do something in another part of Belfast you don't normally go to. I don't know what the equivalent would be in London. Another place, socially and economically, maybe even, you know, geographically just, in another part of London, you go and you do something there. Yeah? And they go and they come to you and do something there. It could be just a very ordinary event, you know, but it could also be something to do with faith issues and how they overmap on politics. The organisation known as ECONI, Evangelical Contribution in Northern Ireland, did incredible work. It tried to challenge, way back in the 80s, this statement for God and Ulster, which was a watchword of many Protestants. I mean, there's an equivalent in just about every culture. Look at the First World War. Hardly one army went into the First World War without believing God was on their side. On the German belt buckle, it said, Gott mit uns, God with us. But For God and Ulster was the Unionist equivalent. And it challenged it with a booklet that came out and said, For God and His glory alone. A very Reformation tradition there. I did some work for them as they morphed into something called the Centre for Contemporary Christianity. And here's something I was asked to do. I researched a project and a book eventually called New Loyalties. And what we were looking at was the way in which in both communities, especially inside that Unionist community, that the working class or post-working class was getting left way behind. They had lost the jobs. They were prone to gang culture. The church was also involved or not involved in all of this. And what we call redemption lift was taking place. And in so much as if you grew up on the Shankill Road, you had your children, there was still a very rough and difficult environment at times. If you became a Christian, your sense of yourself and your possibilities and are enhanced. You're not spending the money on things you might have done anymore, and you want your children to get on well, and there's an opportunity to get a house over in Carrickfergus where you'll move. Now, you might come back loyally to your church on a Sunday when you're in your shinier car than you used to have, but fundamentally, to the people who are still in that estate, you look like somebody who has drifted off and is only making that token attempt to reconnect with your origins. Does it make sense? So I tried to explore that and look at it, diagnose it, if you like, a little bit, statistically even, and ask why that should be and how it is, and what could churches do to try to redress that. Through the help of a friend of mine, Baptist, former Baptist Spurgeon's College lecturer, Peter Stevenson, now in South Wales, from my home town originally, Peter gave me the name of Baptist Church to visit in South London to get some ideas for some of the stuff that was happening here. And we tried to rethink how the church could counter some of that dangerous drift away and open itself a lot more to community, you know, at every kind of level, in particularly in places like Belfast. Forgiveness. A lot of people have looked at people who, through a Christian faith, were able to say, "I forgive you," almost straight away. They found it in themselves. Gordon Wilson's a classic example, and the Enniskillen bomb 20, 30 years ago, who on TV before the world said, I want to say I forgive. But I know people who were impacted by those kind of incidents, and they said, "I can't do that. I'm a badass victim. I can't feel that. I can't do that." And for the media to take those stories and pump them up as media stories makes me feel bad. It's not that they, I mean, this person who said that to me in particular would have said that she admired Gordon Wilson. But for the media to lift that, to sacralise that, to lift it up, and you just feel you can't do that. You're not in a position to do that. Leaves you with a difficult situation. So I hope that's been comprehensive enough. I hope that I've given you some examples to cheer your heart. You know, that there are wonderful things that have happened, wonderful, wonderful things, and wonderful people who have kept society moving on and brought a lot of healing, I think. But also the complexity, what I call the ethical complexity on the ground of actually manifesting what peace and justice and Christian discipleship should look like.